discussing here on this broadcast, and also the National Archives do have the records there. So all of your listeners, if we want to, can go to Washington and see the records themselves.
Well, thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Sinnett. You've been listening to History Counts. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been talking today with Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. Thanks for joining us. And please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can find an archive of this program and others in the series. If you'd like to make any comments, please send your email to ken@mdrtalk.org.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Pearl Harbor, Day of Deceit, an edition of the series History Counts, which originates at WPKN-FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. The program, produced by MDR Productions Incorporated, was hosted by Ken McDermott Rowe and engineered by David Schwartz. Sprouts is distributed by and coordinated by Pacifica Radio Network. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
And welcome to that melodic introduction to Bathrobe's Pier's Broadsides. I'm Robert Norse. This is a two-hour show from 6 to 8, actually a little late this evening, but here I am, on the subject of, well, local politics, civil rights, sleeping in the rain, things like that. Indeed, it is raining tonight out there. Particularly interested in changing laws that criminalize poor people, stopping institutional abuses that deny the community the power that it should have so that each individual has the rights to which she should be entitled, and particularly those who are poor and homeless, since other folks seem to have more power to assert their rights if only they chose to do so. You're tuned to Free Radio, or Freak Radio as we call it, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. And the call-in number here for the next 2 hours will be, and will remain, actually, for the indefinite future, 831-427-3772, 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can also try a secondary number in case that number is busy or inoperative, 469-3119. Again, 427-3772 or 469-3119. And this information is also online. Go to freakradio.org. I think it's online. And you can get more information by calling us if you want to do that, by calling our voicemail, leave us a message. If you're not techno-savvy with the Internet, you can always use the phone line and the phone number to call. The voicemail is 427-4523, 427-4523. If any of these numbers escape you, there's one number you should always remember. That's my number and also the number for HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and it's pretty easy to remember, 423-HUFF, 423-HUF. So, welcome to Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Again, call in number in case you want to talk. We've got news to report, complaints to register, commendations to give, or anything of that sort, 427-3772. I'm going to begin with some interviews, fairly recent interviews in the last few days, and I may jump back a bit. Actually, I think I'll jump back, now that I've mentioned it, to an earlier interview, because, well, frankly, I like what Ron Paul says about the war. He's running for president on the Republican side of the ticket, the Republican side of the doomed House, the Republican side of the empire. And here's some stuff from people downtown who were tabling for him.
Running in front of Borders Bookstore. We have some questionable, suspicious types with the Ron Paul Evolution T-shirts. All right, how much is this dowdy congressman paying you to hang out on Pacific Avenue?
Absolutely nothing.
Absolutely nothing.
And what's your name?
My name is Patty.
And you are?
Thomas.
And you're, let's see this subversive literature. Ron Paul, 2008. Just who is Ron Paul? What does he want here anyway?
Ron Paul is a constitutionalist. He's basically for every amendment. The Constitution believes in our country.
I've heard that before.
Likewise. I've heard it ever since I could start to vote before.
Now, what is Ron Paul going to do for women?
For women?
You're a woman. You look like a woman.
He's going to quit taxing us so much. No, he's never voted to raise taxes.
Has he voted for the Equal Rights Amendment? I guess he wasn't around when it was being voted on.
He voted against the Iraq War. He's against the Patriot.
Reading from a script. You know what this man is.
You're nervous.
Oh, sorry.
That big beard of yours.
Well, no, I think it's a tape recorder.
You're lost in it.
Well, who's complaining? And here's another man without a shirt. Your name, sir?
My name is Brendan.
You too have a series of pamphlets again.
I do. I'm a Ron Paul supporter all the way. I'm very much a fan of the Constitution of the United States, and I don't like it when people, you know, tend to ignore it.
Well, we saw Ron last in an iPod broadcast with a bunch of Republican Neanderthals. Why would Ron let himself be seen in such company?
Well, you have to stand out from the crowd, and that's a good way to do it.
Thunder along with the mammoths, eh?
That's right, that's right. When you have Ron Paul with such other company, with such, in my opinion, minimal intellect and certainly no concrete beliefs, it really makes a drastic contrast as to what the...
Ron voted against the Patriot Act.
He did vote against the Patriot Act.
He voted against the Use of Force Act of 2001. I doubt it.
He did, absolutely.
Really?
Yes, he did.
2001 Use of Force Act.
He has never voted to use military force. He actually advocated that if we were going to go to war, that we should declare war constitutionally as prescribed in the Constitution. And he,
an old fuddy-duddy, eh?
A guaranteed constitutionalist.
Now, you're here. Are you local from Santa Cruz, or are you guys from out of town?
I'm originally from Santa Cruz, yes.
And what about these other agitators?
I believe they are from Santa Cruz County, if I'm not mistaken.
And are you guys actually starting a Santa Cruzans for Ron Paul group?
There one exists, yes.
And how can people get in touch with this group?
You can go to meetup.com and Santa Cruz Meetup.
And what kind of events do you have planned to bring home the message of, there's a war on and likely to be a war against Iran. What's old Ron going to do about that?
Well, if he was, he currently, as a member of Congress, he votes against, for instance, the resolution against Iran that the House passed some months ago. He voted against that. He has many, many speeches on the House of the Floor stating his opinion. He has a great book called Foreign Policy of Freedom by Ron Paul. I suggest anybody pick that up. And you can learn in depth his foreign policy stances, and they're very well documented.
Again, we've been talking with
Brendan.
Brendan, let me ask one of these other questionable people here. Sure she is. I'm confronting this poor woman again with a tape recorder and a beard at the same time. What has been your reception here in Santa Cruz? I mean, are you getting a lot of people who are interested, or half the people are interested? What's your general feeling about it?
It's a mixed group. We have the partiers, you know, that are just here to party, and we have the people that are aware.
What do the Democrats say when they come up? Any Democratic Party folks or Green Party gurus? What do they say?
Got some Hillary supporters out here.
Oh, what about Obama fans? What do they say?
Yeah. He successfully shot himself in the foot recently, wanting to go into Pakistan.
Well, you got to be tough. You got to be rough. Well, that's what some people say. So I know a lot of people seem to be just sort of drifting by. I mean, is there much anybody volunteered to help, for instance?
Well, we did, and certainly. I just learned about Ron Paul about 12 days ago. So, I mean,
how were you hornswoggled into this activity?
Because it was love at first sight, actually. No, I went to the website. RonPaul2008.com, and just educated myself, saw what he stood for, listened to the debates, saw him on all of the late-night shows, and, you know, that was...
He had the effrontery to get 30% of the vote, the highest percentage of all the Republicans. Obviously, they must have rigged the voting, right?
I don't think so. That was those were activist-run groups online, right? As far as I understand.
Well, I think there was. Yeah, I think there was a.
Run by a group of honest kids, I think.
I think what you actually had is, instead of having an electorate where you actually have people put in a vote and then it's voted on by the electoral board, you actually...
Diebold should have taken over. We would have gotten a more sensible result, as we did with Measure R in Berkeley. Any local political stands you guys are taking, or is it all simply national politics? Are you urging, for example, that Santa Cruz become a sister city to a city in Iraq or Iran to stop the bombing of those cities?
No, not quite. I think we're going to stick to Santa Cruz.
How about a peace conference with the insurgent groups, short-circuiting the warmongers in the White House?
No, I am angry.
Oh.
No, and yes, a difference of opinion. A split in the group. Go ahead, sir.
Well, no, I would say yes, because if there's an opportunity to discuss peace opposed to war or factionism or a fracturing society and bring people together to speak, then you have an opportunity to actually understand what they need and what they want.
Are you suggesting we should talk with the traitorous men who are killing our boys and girls abroad as they shoot down Iranians and Iraqis?
Of course not. That's not what I'm saying at all.
I hope not.
But also, the people over there, the young children who have not done any wrong, are the people who will be leading that country later on. And if you have enough adults that are sensible enough to have a good example to raise those children and maybe bring the children over.
These people are shooting down American troops. Don't they deserve to be killed?
I think that they don't deserve to be killed, and we don't deserve to be over there.
For heaven's sake, what are you, a traitor?
Absolutely not.
No,
I'll bleed red, white, and blue, man.
I do think we need to go over there and save the guerrillas, though. Yeah.
And do what?
Save the guerrillas.
You mean the zoo gorillas?
Seven of them were shot since January.
You're talking about the real gorillas, not the arm carrying, but the gorillas with the hairy arms.
In the Congo, yes. I'm very upset about that. I read it in Newsweek today, and I'm just...
This is another subject which we shall be discussing sometime in the very distant future.
The reason why foreigners should go to another country to do any combat is to protect the gorillas. Protect those that... Yeah. They're just wonderful beings. Anyway.
Oh, you're obviously mentally ill. Have you had a 51-50 analysis lately?
And I think Ron Paul would agree with me. Yeah.
Again, we've been talking to...
Patty.
And
Thomas.
Thank you. Talking with Santa Barbara Dan, is it Delightful Dan, Dougalicious Dan, or the Hoop-De-Doo-Doo Dan?
What? I decided today, Dan.
There you go. The Dubious Dan, perhaps. Don, there's another Dubious Dan. We can't. Anyway, Dan, how's it going? You just came. You traveled to Santa Barbara.
Well, reality these days is so vague that it almost doesn't suspend my disbelief anymore.
I see.
Happy 9/11.
And or Dick Cheney Day, as I like to call
it. Cheney Day.
Yeah.
Dick Bader.
Remember, victory to the Iraqi resistance, as I like to say.
Yeah. So I've been down to the valley, back to Santa Barbara and back. And the second day I was there, I said the same old thing, except it's worse. It literally was like being in hell.
How so?
The fire was raging and it was snowing ash out of the sky.
So it was a natural disaster. You're not talking about the condition of homeless people in Santa Barbara.
It blanketed a condition of complete sellout and vacuousness, generally speaking.
The infamous Nancy McCready, perhaps. Enough said.
Yes, and she had to go for a brief stay at the hospital. She had some lung ailment, and it wasn't due to the fire. It was something that was ongoing that got real bad.
What about Beaming Bob Hansen?
Yes, so I hung out with him, and he got on the roster for city council again. And I went to a meeting or two with him. It was, I don't know, all these committees, do-gooder committees that we all have come to know and love.
What about Peppery Peter Marin?
You know, I was sitting and talking with a friend up by the Indian statue on the corner of Victoria.
And all this is very well for those of you who know something about Santa Barbara homeless politics. These are homeless activists that... Dan is talking about. Santa Barbara was really quite a hotbed of homeless activism in the 80s when they actually repealed their sleeping ban in 1986 by the combination of lobbying, protest, even organizing social service providers, and a massive threat to have all the homeless people across the country come to sleep in under the fig tree, as they called the large tree next to Highway 101 in those days, to protest the city's ban on sleeping. And for 3 years, it was eliminated, and then because they didn't want the people to come to Santa Barbara to sleep under the fig tree. They were afraid that it would drive away the tourists, and also it was a kind of a summer home of Ronald Reagan when he was president in the 80s, of course. Anyway, it's been kind of quiescent since then, and like many communities along the coast, Santa Cruz included, it's been getting increasingly hostile in terms of its legislation toward the homeless, although they have done some things around vehicular struggles that have been successful, in part due to the work of public defender, former chief public defender, and then private attorney Glenn Maurer, who took on a lot of homeless cases. I haven't spoken to him recently. I've written several articles about Glenn's struggle on behalf of vehicular residents. Here in Santa Cruz, we have a group called LIVE, Living in Vehicles Excellently, which is really, so far, sort of a very, in its preliminary stages of organization, it looks like. It's run by homeless vehicle dweller Donna Dice, who is going to court to fight tickets given her by Chief Ranger John Wallace for parking her RV in the Lighthouse Field parking lot A, and I've talked about this some months ago. The Parks and Rec changed its rules, restriped the area, apparently to get rid of large RVs, and John Wallace moved in and demanded she leave. She said, no, I'm here during the day. I have a right to be here. You lease this place from the state. The state has certain requirements for RVs, might even requirements for people who are disabled, which Donna is also disabled. John Wallace apparently didn't
regard this as an adequate reason and gave her two citations, well, one and then one later. She's taking them both to court, and I actually saw her in court yesterday during the HUF meeting, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom get-together that happens in the basement of the county building in the so-called American Cafe or the county cafeteria between 9:30 and 11:30 on Wednesday mornings. Anybody's invited to come on down. We'll throw a cup of coffee at you. Actually, we'll kick down some money so you can go do whatever you want with a cup of coffee. Hopefully drink it or maybe drink something healthier. Who knows? Anyway, Santa Barbara is fighting the same kind of struggle we are in Santa Cruz, which is to restore, retain rights for homeless people against the kind of the increasing gentrification, the attempt of the rich, the well-to-do, and the fearful, in some respects, too, to drive out the poor folks living on the street, to make it look better, look ritzier, look more upscale, appeal to a particular mentality of person. And in the process, of course, passing all kinds of laws that criminalize poor people, like the Santa Cruz sleeping ban, which, for all you newcomers, makes it illegal for homeless people to sleep between the hours of 11 o'clock at night and 8:30 in the morning on any public property whatsoever, since tonight there's shelter space even in this rain for only 160 individuals, walk-in emergency shelter space for only 160, including the winter armory. That means that the rest of the 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people out there, and we're talking about Santa Cruz City homeless, not the county, which there are significantly more, most of them have no place to go and face $97 tickets. And to fight this, we're doing a lawsuit, some of us in HUF and the Human Rights Organization. Activists have been working on this for a long time. Housing Now in California, another group is working on it. Humanity for Homeless, run by Tim Rumford, also working on it. And we're gathering plaintiffs, and I mention this every other time I come on the air. It looks like we're still pushing to get the 10 plaintiffs we need as a starting group who are regularly in contact with us, giving us the information we need for the declarations to be made so that the attorneys can file the papers in federal court. And we're hoping to do what was done in Los Angeles, which is to say, get the court to rule that it's cruel and unusual punishment, as well as a violation of certain other constitutional rights, perhaps, to arrest someone for sleeping when you have no legal place for them to go, and you're simply just saying it's a crime for you to sleep at night, which sounds pretty ridiculous, but in fact is the law in Santa Cruz. It's not that homeless people want to sleep anywhere and everywhere, though some believe they have the right to sleep anywhere in the earth. That's one point of view, the spiritual right to camp, as it was described a couple years ago. Another position, and one that I have been pushing for, is that people have the right to sleep somewhere. And if you don't have the right to sleep somewhere, then these laws are completely unconstitutional. And every time a police officer wakes up a homeless person, it's a form of assault. Or assault and battery, if they touch the person, if you will. That, of course, is not the position of the Santa Cruz Police Department and Chief Howard Scarry, nor is the position of Danette Shoemaker and Steve Hammack's Parks and Rec. So, I'm going to be talking more about this stuff. I'm going to leave Santa Barbara behind for the moment and turn to a little more musical activity. This is the 200th anniversary of SAFE, 200th week of SAFE. SAFE is Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, or Street Performers Against Foolish Enforcement, a group that has been playing music started every Wednesday, then folks started doing Tuesday as well, then Monday, and it's actually spread out so there's sort of the 10 o'clock group of musicians called the 10 o'clock club. And I also have to say that a lot of hardcore Skid Row-looking types have also showed up in front of New Leaf, which has forced me to get into a dialogue on the issue with myself, and I spent the evening down there last night wondering about it, talking to folks. It certainly doesn't look middle class anymore, and it doesn't look like an artist colony or a bunch of musicians. It looks like street downtown San Francisco in the Tenderloin at that point. But are people being abusive? Are they blocking the area? Are they hurting people? No, but they are passing around booze a bit. We have a phone call. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hi, Robert. It's Emily. My show's guest who's coming to dinner. I just realized that I stopped recording my show. I didn't stop recording my show.
Oh, you're on the air, Emily. I'm sorry. Did you want to be on the air? You want me to talk to you off air?
Damn it. No, whatever. How's it going, everybody? I'm eating pizza right now. I just got back from hours worth of traffic.
Hey.
And I just realized I didn't shut off my recording, so.
Oh, you know, I think your recording got lost.
Oh, shit.
I'm sorry.
All right, well.
I'm sorry. Yeah, there were actually several. There was one thing. There were three different auditions. Well, let me talk to you about it off air if you want. You can
sure.
hold on.
All right. Have a good show, Robert.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that is such a disappointment when your recording doesn't gets lost, particularly if you want to keep archives of your show. I know that. I had a good show about 3 weeks ago with Professor Franklin Williams up on campus, African-American professor who is also on the board of directors of the Homeless Service Center. And he didn't come into the studio, but he phoned in. We had a great interview in which he savaged some corrupt and inappropriate practices at the Homeless Service Center. And that entire show, unfortunately, got into a corrupted file and got lost. But I'm afraid Emily's show is also not available anymore. Well, and by the way, if you do want to hear an old show on Free Radio Santa Cruz from this, at least from one of my shows, www.huffsantacruz.org is where to go. www.huffsantacruz, all small letters, all one word, .org. And then you go down the website to find the words Bathrobes, Piers, Broadside. That's my show. And you can listen to them, old shows. It isn't very well archived in terms of the descriptions of the shows. In fact, the last 3 or 4 months, you just got to start listening and figure out what's going on without any descriptions. But some of the earlier shows do have descriptions in case you're looking for interviews with people or particular topics. You can find them on earlier shows. And hopefully we're going to be, with the help of some doughty volunteers, I will be doing some updating of the website so you can hear old shows. Generally, for those that don't get corrupted in the process. So here's a little something from, as I was saying, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression. Their 200th week. They began in 2004. I think it was in January, just around this time of year. And so it's almost been 4 years now that they've been out there on the streets. They were there as a way of protesting the downtown ordinances, which were instituted originally in 1994 by Mayor Kennedy, Supervisor Coonerty, who was then Councilmember Coonerty, the older Coonerty, Neil Coonerty, owner of the bookshop Santa Cruz, and other Mike Rotkin, UC instructor and endlessly Councilmember on the city of Santa Cruz. And the laws got worse in 2002 and 2003 when they instituted things like the Move Along Every Hour law, all the sidewalk is forbidden except for a few feet out on the curb or out on the right next to the curb for performers, tablers, and particularly or panhandlers or people who just want to sit down. It became a matter of principle for street performers to say, no, we're going to take back the space. And for 4 years, street performers every Wednesday night have done that. They're violating a number of ordinances being there, but police ignore them. In a way, you might say, I like it. That's great in some respects. In other respects, it's kind of a token situation where you have one area where people can exercise their rights briefly, but for the rest of the time in the rest of the places, it's kind of closed down, no-go zone, sort of like they give you a protest pen in some places if you want to protest President Bush several miles away from where he happens to be doing his thing. Anyway, we have another caller. It's Free Radio. What's your name, caller?
Hi, Robert. It's Madison.
Hi, Madison.
Local international artist.
Uh-huh.
You know, these people, Rotkin and Coonerty, they're just Joes from Manhattan. And let me tell you, as a native and a local to the art scene from the end of the beat on up, and being international, we would prefer if these people who want a scrubbed, clean little city move to Sunnyvale. because this is an art town, and just get out of the way because you clogged the drain. They move here from Manhattan, and it's me first. In the name, push everybody out of the way. My thing first.
Well, I don't know.
That's
you know,
not the way California
you know, Madison, I actually don't know that. I think, you know, Rotkin and Coonerty have been here quite a while. The Coonerty family. I mean,
no,
Coonerty, you know,
no, they moved in late. They're foreigners compared
well,
to...
Well, hang on. Coonerty, I mean, we're all foreigners in some respects. I mean, Coonerty has been running a bookshop and actually, in many respects, pretty nice to the clientele. I mean, in his
actually,
own...
The rudest person
in, wait a minute. In his own way, he's been kind of mellow in his own little territory. I mean, although there are some people who have a lot of complaints about him, who, you know, I mean, he has banned me there for 13 years. But, you know, that's because of my protest activities. The problem with Coonerty and Rotkin is that they are phony progressives, that they use the progressive label, but then they come down and criminalize people on the local level. And I, you know, I don't know about their how they deal with art situations. You'd know more about that, Madison. But
this has been all over the state.
Yeah, but I wouldn't want to say that. I mean, there are a lot of people who are new. I've got nothing against new people showing up in town. And I also wouldn't want to characterize Rotkin and Coonerty as new. They're pretty old. They're, you know. You know, you may regard them as new as far as you're concerned.
Well, no, it's the attitude that screwed up California is what I'm talking about. This is the pivotal point where you could mark it in art history. And it's like, go, you want to live in Gladman? Go to Sunnyvale. Because we don't want that. We want an art town. And it's, I left here when those people came in, and I returned to a town that was drug-ridden, abuse-ridden, an excuse. I mean, this is a ghetto for the arts. I mean, you couldn't find it anywhere. I had to share my stuff for it to even take a new direction.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I'm concerned, they should be voted completely off and out.
Uh-huh.
The planning after the earthquake has been horrid. Like you said, nowhere to sit. There's no performance spaces. These are the things that make the core of Santa Cruz.
Well, remember, we have the Firefly Cafe. We have the art.
Federal Fly. We love that.
The art area is next to it. I mean, there are some areas for it, but I mean, I can't say in terms of comparison. You perhaps are more of an expert on that. My concern, of course, is.
Oh, no, this is a horrid.
You know, my concern is the poor people here and how they're treated, the fact there's no rent control, the fact that, you know, you have.
No, I agree with you on this. Poor people, too. They've just been shoved to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the poor are artists, and the spaces haven't been created for them. And the, you see, it's like the potlatch theory has to come to the top around here. Not the meth latch, the potlatch. And that's when you give, you get. The more you give, the more you get.
Okay, well, thank you.
The more artists you have, the more people are going to want to come and see the colorful flavor of the town, and it will benefit all you little people
It sounds good, Madison. I would like to, of course, know of a town where it's actually worked, and because, I mean, that would be a useful model. And even if there is no such town, no, that doesn't mean it shouldn't be tried as a seminal, you know, kind of experiment. Thanks for calling in. I'm moving on to the next segment here, but Madison, you can always call back at some point if you'd like. Again, here's SAFE, 200th anniversary stuff. And I'm going to take a breather.
Well, it's what time is it? It's around 9:15 at the 200th anniversary of the Wednesday SAFE. Musicians are out here strumming away with guitars, and we have another musician,
Warren West. I play violin and drums and other instruments.
And how is the Wednesday treating you?
Oh, good Wednesday. And
any hassles from police here at this particular site? Or?
No. I just got the normal run-of-the-mill harassment tickets of bicycle helmets. And even though I'm 55, I'm not 16. And numerous red light tickets. My first red light ticket ever on a bicycle with a bicycle trailer on a light that's been dysfunctioning on River Street there for 6 months. It's only stuck on the yellow for like 1.5 seconds before it turns green.
And particular police officers have a hard-on for you?
And I've got parking tickets on Halloween, which they said was free parking. It turns out it's not an accepted holiday by the parking people. I mean, come on, people. Is this
triple fine or just ordinary tickets?
$25. That's
ordinary tickets. So you say you also had you had a kind of a change. You've been able to scale down the penalties for an encounter you had with a Blue Lagoon bouncer?
Yeah, it was skipped down to 1 hour counseling, plead guilty. So I just, rather than go to court and draw it all out, I'll just sweep it under the rug and do 1 hour counseling. I think it's a waste of money that they ever filed in the first place.
Okay. Well, at least you're not afraid to come on downtown and play your instrument.
No. No, I wish I brought more instruments. I didn't know it would be so nice. I would bring more tomorrow.
It is nice, isn't it?
Yeah, it is nice.
Well, thanks, Warren. Any other reports from the street you want to pass on?
No, but I'm doing sculptures throughout Santa Cruz, wildlife sculptures. So if you have an 8-foot plot you want to do a 30-foot egret on, let me know.
A 30-foot
egret?
Wow. And what kind of material are you sculpting in?
Steel and concrete. It's realistic. It'll be a good nature scene. It'll last 100 years when I, you know.
Wow. Well, sounds like a bit out of my league, but thank you, Warren.
Yeah, you're welcome, Robert.
All right, man. On December 2nd, 2007. I'm down here in front of New Leaf, kind of leaning against the infamous forbidden fence between Alfresco's and Cafe Campesino. And just a moment ago, I observed an elderly host advising a woman with a large pooch here on a leash, a pretty middle-class looking person, perhaps patronizing the Alfresco's restaurant, that dogs are not legal on the mall. And the response of this woman is, of course, to ignore it and continue to hug her companion, talk to her friend, and tend to her dog. So, actually, I think that's a very healthy response. But it's interesting, the response of the host was not to call the police, but to apparently take off in another direction. I'm still here. I see no sign of a police presence. And apparently everything is rosy. We'll see if they're still here when I come back in about 10 or 15 minutes. I'm here in front of New Leaf around 2 o'clock on Sunday talking with...
My name is Brent Adams. I play a Plastic Barrel downtown. You know me. Come on.
What about it, Brent?
Mayor Ryan Coonerty was voted mayor sometime last week, maybe Tuesday.
Tuesday, yes.
So I just happened to be having a cocktail with a friend at Vita when they put out a spread there, and then all the people from that voting at the city council came down to Vita for
the
a big celebration.
City council came to Vita's?
John Laird, all the notables, everybody, all the business
people. This is
people.
On Tuesday?
Yes. About 50 people crowded
in the evening?
Yes. And then I was like, hey, 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 this sounds like a scene for me to do something crazy. I've had enough tequila in my bloodstream to... So I waited for the musicians to stop. There was a really nice jazz band. And then I took my perch upon a bar stool, stood up. I said, ladies and gentlemen, can we have a big round of applause for Ryan, Mayor Ryan? Hey, everybody claps.
Uh-huh.
And I also want to give him props for spearheading the fight to end the sleeping ban. Right on, Ryan, everybody! And everyone's all, And then one guy's like, take it home. I'm like, at least I have a home. It was good. It was
nicely
good.
Nicely done, you drunken slut.
It was really awesome. And that's the end of my story. I ran away after that.
And he ran away. Well, Brent, well done. May the Coonerty not be with you.
Thank you. Yeah.
And that was an interview on the street, but I have a call-in from Seaside. Are you there?
Yes, this is Bob.
And what's your name, caller? Give it to me again.
Bob Oliver. I do a radio program on another channel here at KRXA 540.
Oh, yeah, so I was listening.
Quantum Leap on Saturday mornings at 11.
Uh-huh, I was listening to KRXA, actually, when I was driving downtown to get this to the show this evening. Yeah, we ran into each other in the parking lot of the county building. And your specialty has to do with, how would you describe it?
Well, trying to be a good citizen in a rotten country at the moment.
That's a big order, yeah.
Yeah, we have a lot of problems that aren't being dealt with. I want to talk to you a little bit about the homeless, but your lead-in really more so that right now I've made rather large discovery. I'm sure there's quite a few people who know it, but the word is very difficult to get out. I've been doing a series of programs on looking into UFOs and alien encounters and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And I'm finding that there are more and more people than I ever believed that have had some kind of a UFO encounter.
Mm-hmm.
Just about every day I'll speak with three or four people that will tell me new stories, firsthand experiences, which is considerably different than looking into the subject, say, a year ago or even 6 months ago.
So you've been interested in the subject for some time?
I have been. I've never felt that I was ever abducted or anything, although my sisters always thought I was pretty weird. But specifically what I wanted to mention is that you can see UFOs with night vision equipment. So if you have third generation night vision equipment, look into the night sky, and chances are within an hour you'll see something fly over that will convince you that we are not alone, that there's a lot more going on in the dark sky than you ever could believe.
Mm-hmm.
But it's real. I met a man in Northern California, in Calistoga, who has had quite an interesting life, where he and his family first saw UFOs battling in the sky back in 1961. So there were nine people that actually saw this occur, which is a convincing scenario for those people to then go through their lives believing and knowing that this sort of thing actually happens.
So your show is on, what, on Saturday mornings, you say?
Saturday morning at 11 a.m.
Right, and that's on a.m.?
540.
I'm going to turn you away from that to talk more about Monterey homeless situation because, one, I'm not really equipped to talk about it, but, two, I'm frankly interested in what's cooking in the county right to the south around civil rights and services for homeless people as far as you found out.
Well, the problem is goes into a lot of depth. It branches out into so many areas that you can pick one and then start getting into all of them. So specifically, in the last 5 years, I've had more of an opportunity than in the past to spend time with homeless people and find out what they're going through. There's a lot of ramifications for being homeless, and there's a lot of homeless people that have different lifestyles as being homeless people. You have a large percentage of ex-military from Vietnam era, and you have women and children and families. You asked about this area, but I think it's best to build a context for it. I was in Sacramento about 2 years ago and learned that they have over 6,000 homeless people in the state capital.
Oh, yeah.
That's incredible, and not very many people recognize a statement like that. In our own area, I don't have any exact count at the present time, but I have spent time talking with the homeless, and you begin to get a whole idea of the social structure in this country by including what the homeless have to say about how things are operating here. There's a lot that's done for the homeless, I think, in our area, but a lot more could be done. But the real issue isn't the homeless, it's the kind of the path that we're on as a nation, the type of problems that we all are going to encounter on the way on this path. And so putting the homeless to the side here for just a moment, think of also about the elderly. who have worked their entire lives simply to see their fortunes dissolved by having to go into the medical expenses in their final years, or to get the type of living care facilities that they need once they get to a point that they can no longer take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Socially, we have both the social and economic problems here in this country. Socially, where we don't have family values any longer that deal with the elderly. We don't have a system of living in which we're able to include the young, the teenager, the entire family, all the way through into the grandparents. We're just totally dysfunctional.
And yeah, I mean, the trouble with this kind of discussion is that, well, you know, it certainly sounds true. The question is, you know, what specifically, I mean, my interest is in taking a little piece of this whole thing and looking at, you know, laws that criminalize poor people in Santa Cruz County, because that's where I'm living. And so I ask you about Monterey County because, you know, I go there occasionally.
It's all the same. And when you bring up the laws that criminalize people, I'll speak to that briefly. We have laws in this country, and we're told that we are a country of laws, but in reality, we are a country of policies. As you know, it's how the homeless are treated as opposed to the laws. They're treated very poorly. They get hauled into court on things that later are dismissed, and they're being harassed.
Well, there are also specific laws designed to give the police selective enforcement powers to harass homeless people, and ranging from open container laws to no sleeping laws to no sitting laws to
no parking laws, no talking laws, no drawing pictures laws.
Well, I don't know about those. I haven't heard of those two. Although we do have, you can't walk through a parking lot in Santa Cruz unless you have a vehicle there now. You can walk through it. You can't loiter there. I mean, it's an attempt to destroy the town square as a community gathering place based on this kind of increased fear that is the, you know, the watchword for politicians to, you know, kind of, frankly, they intensify their power that way. Well, Bob, I think I'm going to roll. I'm going to invite people to talk, you know, call into your show if they want to kind of tap your main subject, which sounds to be like it's alien encounters. Would that be the issue, or are we talking, is that a fair way to describe it?
I'd like to recap it by saying that if you see a UFO with night vision goggles, and anyone can, it changes your whole perspective and you start looking at much broader questions. Are we alone is one of them, and the answer to that obviously is no, we're not.
And you've seen these yourself.
I have. And
when was the first time you saw one?
About 5 weeks ago. The gentleman that I referred you to from Calistoga brought down 4 pair of night vision goggles. We invited people from the radio broadcast to meet us at Monterey Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And within 15 minutes, 4 people using the glasses saw UFOs. And then the second round of people, we had 2 more people that night.
Did you take any photographic evidence of this or not?
I don't. This fellow's name is Ed Grimsley, and he does have some photographs. Graphic work that he's currently doing. It's not been released yet, but he's shown this his equipment to over 300 people that are believers. Once you see it,
well, is there a website you can recommend to people? Because I'm gonna, you know, I want to pass this on to people, but I want to pass on as well. So
I don't have a website associated with him yet. He will be having one, I'm sure, in the near future. He's producing a documentary movie on this. But if your listeners can go to Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Oh, yeah.
All these types of things are covered.
That's that's on what, late night on?
10 a.m. until 2, and that's on easier access on 1460 and 1080 a.m.
Yeah. I'm familiar with that. Well, Bob, thank you for calling in. If you find anything more specific happening there, I'd like to know about it. In terms of, again, my focus is on homeless folks, civil rights, particular abuses that come up. Let me know. Give us a call.
And I want to thank you. I spent about an hour and a half copying down all of your bumper sticker slogans yesterday. So thank you for that.
Well, there'll be a charge. It's 10 cents per name. You know, 10 cents per slogan. So
You've got a recording now. sorry, recording.
Ah, yes, yes. Okay, well, thank you. And
keep up the good work.
And the same to you, Bob.
Thank you.
All righty. And that's what happens when you talk to someone who's writing all the bumper stickers on your car, and you get them to call your show, I guess. I don't know much about UFOs. There isn't much intersection with that and homeless people that I've found yet. But if anybody has any specific intersection, sure, feel free to call in. Although it's frankly, it's not an area that I either expertise or any comfort in talking about. And some of that has to do with because I tend to regard the issue as fringe, if you will, and perhaps unfairly because I haven't researched it, you know. Back to the street and street interviews, which is more my normal beat.
By a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to be. Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Is there a connection? Who owns the land to be to my daily eviction? Who owns the land and the extermination? Who owns the land?
Say no to bigotry at the bookshop Santa Cruz.
And what you're listening to now is the Sunday protest in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz, owned by Supervisor Neil Coonerty, and still, I guess, the lair until mid-December of Mayor Ryan Coonerty, and it's a place where we've been haunting the sidewalk, encouraging people to take literature, register their opinions, do interviews. We actually played a TV, we had a TV playing an old VHS of a 1994 sitting ban, well, I call them the police mini riots of that year, but they were, it was a large protest that actually broke the back of the sitting ban that Kennedy, Rotkin, and the elder Coonerty put together in 1994. Originally, there was a sitting ban that you couldn't sit down on any sidewalk anywhere in town passed by the Santa Cruz City Council. That, due to extensive protests, was both made unenforceable and also, for the first time ever, it was reversed by two judges. I believe it was Commissioner Salazar and Judge Barton both agreed that was not constitutional law. And it's interesting because some of the objections they had to the sitting ban then, which one of which was the fact that it had a warning provision. And you would think, well, having a warning provision is better because people are warned, then they get to move and they won't get ticketed. But if there's a warning provision, it really means the police can selectively enforce it. At least that was how the courts ruled on it. Because you could warn someone and you could choose not to warn somebody else. And there are still warning provisions attached to some parts of the downtown ordinances, which haven't been challenged, mainly because attorneys and activists haven't turned their attention there. Perhaps they will in the future, where part of the panhandling law was challenged like a year and a half, 2 years ago in the John Maurer case. It was found unconstitutional when Maurer was ticketed for having a fuck the pigs little sign in his hat, meaning as an expression of disrespect and anger toward the police department for previous harassments on the sidewalk. And the police gave him a ticket for panhandling with obscene language, which was kind of a hoot. And he walked away with a fistful of money, and we got a changed law. There's plenty of parts of the downtown ordinance panhandling law that are still unconstitutional. For instance, the law itself not only makes it illegal to sit down or to panhandle, to ask for spare change or money or anything of value within 14 feet of any building in, I think it's actually anywhere in town. I mean, I double-check my little handy-dandy section of the panhandling law. Any verbal request or any nonverbal request they expand that it made with a sign is illegal, for example, after dark at any time on any public property, and you're guilty of an infraction if you do it once, or a misdemeanor if you do it twice within 6 months. It's illegal to sit down on the sidewalk with a sign
panhandling, which you would think that's strange because you see that happening all the time, but that's actually technically illegal as a part of this law. It's also illegal to hold up a sign that can be seen by a person who you are soliciting within 14 feet of a building. So that means not only do you have to be 14 feet out, but the only people you can panhandle are those who are walking 14 feet away from the building, which, of course, is another absurdity, which the police don't enforce, but which is part of the law. And the law is it's a nasty law cooked up by merchants to give the police essentially a blank check to go after people. And the police kind of treat this as a blank check. They often create parts of the law that don't even exist. They ignore parts of the law that do exist. And it's very selectively enforced, so that it really depends on whether a police officer decides, you know, that he wants to focus on you. Hence, a fellow named Mr. TV, you may have seen him downtown. He has a little act where he has a kind of a mock TV screen, holds up little props, kind of puppets, and then afterward passes the hat. You find him sometimes in front of near Cafe Campesino, or sometimes down by the bookshop Santa Cruz. He's gotten 5 tickets in the last year. I believe 3 or 4 of them have been for panhandling, even though he's just a street performer. He isn't bothering anybody. He isn't illegally placed. He just he ran afoul of some host or some cop. And then when he got to court, they didn't prosecute. So he had to come all the way down from where he lives, one of those towns in the South Bay area, and go to court several times, and then showed up to find the prosecution didn't arrive because they were just harassing him. So we need to address this kind of crap. And there people are going to say, yeah, but what about, let's say, you know, are the hardcore folks hanging out in front of New Leaf for the last week or two? And really the answer to that has to do with, a lot of the problem there has to do with alcohol. I'm not a supporter of the open container law, which says that adults shouldn't be allowed to drink unless they have a house, primarily. That's what the law really is, it amounts to. But I don't believe that people should be allowed to be drunk and abusive in public places and hang out there for long periods of time being drunk and abusive. That I don't. And there actually are laws that cover this. I mean, it's illegal to be drunk and abusive. It's maybe a little hard to enforce, but actually police haven't had trouble enforcing it individually, and they wouldn't really have trouble doing it if they specifically paid some attention to that. And I would have no objection to that being enforced either by the community or by police officers or by somebody else. Although, frankly, well-behaved drunks, as far as I'm concerned, are fine. It has to do, again, with behavior. I may be playing some tape on this issue later in the show or on Sunday when I come back between 9:30 and 1 in the afternoon when I have a long version of the show on Sunday. So, if you want to call in, you can on any of these subjects, 427-3772. Madison, an earlier caller, asked me to talk about the Homeless Service Center. And I feel a little bit awkward here because while I had a conversation about that issue and have had numerous conversations about that issue with some folks who are more closely in touch with it, with the problems out at the Homeless Service Center than I am, I don't have a lot of these stats at my fingertips. I do recall from Franklin Williams, the professor, the instructor up at UCSC, he's a professor who goes out with students and does all kinds of volunteer work, and he's on the board, Homeless Service Center. He found like 6 dead rats in the Homeless Service Center's kitchen. That's what he reported. They wouldn't let him into the kitchen. Homeless Service Center personnel became significantly less friendly to Huff and Human Rights Organization activists after I aired that segment on the radio. There was concern about staff in the showers and mold. There were numerous concerns out there about rules that were created simply for the convenience of the staff. So people, for example, couldn't hang around during the day. There was no sanctuary. You couldn't stay there. Of course, you can't have shelter there at night yet, although that may now be changing. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hi, Robert. You asked me to call the Homeless Service Center and see if I could get a call back from them.
Okay.
And nobody got a call back. We had 3 people call.
Oh, really?
And, yes. And then also I've had, you know, I speak with the homeless when they go by my house because I live in a very active place. And five people since I've moved in back home 4 years ago have told me that one of the employees there, one of the top-level managers, is selling heroin. They've told me that people have gone through their stuff and taken things. Another woman told me that she was missing documents for, like, stocks, and she was trying to sell and things like that. So I'm pretty disgusted when I hear this. I think that it sounds like it needs an audit, a changing of the guard. It's just been rampant through all, apparently, since Bush flew in with the quake. And there's been a number of people from out of town who were placed in positions and were taking advantage, and they've cleaned some of it out due to audits. But I understand that some drug dealing has to go on in order to catch drug dealers. I'm actually pro-hallucinogen and pro-pot. I'm anti-meth and anti-heroin. And if there's any inkling whatsoever, and the excuse that, oh, the poor needs to deal drugs, like Cecil Williams has, is just a pile of crap.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're, you know, if he's involved in that in San Francisco, then he needs to be taken out too. And
well,
all
know,
his cronies with Willie Brown.
You know, Madison, what I'd like you to do is, you know, what you really need to do is to amass some specific statistics and actually do some, you know, get in touch
with
people.
Well, why I'm calling is because Bush is a czar of homelessness.
Uh-huh.
And I really hate the word. I think it should be changed to home wanted. Flew into San Francisco, and I can see it now. Care for Cash seems to be working with some of the people, and you said it's a very diverse population. Well, I can just see the Bush crowd setting that up all over the country, and again, gigantic poverty pimps lying in their pockets, selling drugs, laundering money, exactly what's happening in Santa Cruz, and it not making it to the street. And it's unacceptable, and it has to be localized in whatever facet possible. You know, with a multiplicity of programs that are designed locally, and any of these feds show up, just get out. You know, we don't need you. We don't need your money. We can keep it all local. Housing, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there needs to be, I mean, it could be a national revolt in terms of, it should start with a tax revolt and go from there. So, you know, I just say that there should be red flags everywhere. And then from the street, I spoke to the mission, about nine guys in front of the mission for 20 minutes, 30 minutes a couple of Sundays ago. And I would say 7 out of 9 were vets. They were seniors. One of them, we spent a lot of time talking about the violence, and he had just come in from Monterey, and he said Monterey is a palace for homeless compared to Santa Cruz. They provide them worn clothes twice a year. Getting fed is easy. They get 2 brand new tents. 2 brand new sleeping bags a year. He said that it's just the Mercedes-Benz of homelessness is in Monterey, and that Santa Cruz is a very icky place to be homeless.
That's interesting.
So that's all I've dealt with in terms of...
Well, I think I'm glad you're soliciting these reports, and again, the more specifics you get, the better. And yeah, I mean, we've had, there was one, as you may remember, who died on the in front of the homeless service center with her 2 dogs. I mean, she was there for months. She kept trying to get her property back from Marcos Banuelos and the various staff there, and she kept reporting great problems, and she eventually died. I mean, I think she got into some kind of survival housing eventually, but it wasn't adequate, and I mean she. The homeless service center doesn't provide the most basic thing, which is emergency shelter, you know, clean access to clean showers, significant storage lockers. There are all kinds of problems here that are not being dealt with.
The other thing I sort of came up with this week, I started thinking how many people we care for in Santa Cruz, and I see all kinds from our 20-year homeless to 20-minute homeless. And what I'm seeing is, I see people dropped in here from Vegas without 50 cents, and Vegas continually ships people here. And other places in the country, they, you know, Fresno, we've gotten them, you know, they just put them on the bus, San Luis, and here they come.
I really kind of like to see that document, although I know it does happen at certain points. I understand Santa Cruz does the same thing, too. You know, it's ship the homeless somewhere else, homeless dumping.
Yeah, it's like half the people have been rerouted. But my feeling is that the rich cities that are doing the rerouting have to pay, and that the cities that are bothering, Santa Cruz and San Francisco and Monterey, we ought to get together and sue the other cities. So that they sue them for not building all the cities, but especially the wealthy cities, for slacking on their low-income.
Well, I don't know that Fresno and you know these other big cities are the wealthy cities. I mean,
no, I'm thinking Atherton, Menlo Park.
And I'm not aware that those cities have any
Pasadena.
I'm not aware that those cities have bus them elsewhere programs. They probably have.
Oh no, what I'm saying is what we should do is go after them. Because all the cities are short on their entry-level, low-income housing. If Santa Cruz, the liberal capital we supposedly are, is back on its building.
Well, you know, I think the reality is that Santa Cruz has adequate funding to be able to deal with certain basic things like shelter, toilets, and campgrounds, and yet they refuse to do it for essentially NIMBY-esque prejudice reasons, a sort of a paranoia and a form of bias. And I think that's not Santa Cruz alone. It's many other cities, too. It's like the kind of sickness that was throughout the South and is still throughout the nation around racial prejudice. It's a similar class prejudice.
Well, I think that a state-level lawsuit, like from Brown's office, suing all the cities that haven't addressed
well, put it together and put it together and do it and work on it.
Everyone needs to call and write.
We're working on our own lawsuit around.
I understand the value of one, and one is important.
We're working on the lawsuit around the sleeping ban, and I encourage you to jump on board that one, Madison. I'm going to roll on you.
Okay, have a good day.
All right. Although these other issues are certainly important too, shelter services and so forth. Right now, however, the issue is, even if you're not asking for any services, not even looking for any shelter, you're just trying to exist, it becomes illegal to sleep after 11 o'clock at night. Pretty ridiculous. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. And what's cooking up in San Francisco? Well, I got an email from Jennifer Friedenbach of the Coalition on Homelessness. And she's got good news and bad news. San Francisco Supervisor Tom Ammiano, has introduced, quote, groundbreaking legislation that would create for the first time minimum standards for the shelter system. These standards would require healthy, I'm reading out of her email, and hygienic conditions in our shelters, create a right for shelter residents to be treated with dignity and respect. It was initiated by the Coalition on Homelessness, for which Jennifer Friedenbach works. And that also puts out the monthly homeless paper street sheet. Some of the highlights include of Ammiano's legislation, treatment of clients with dignity and respect, freedom from physical violence, fresh drinking water at all times, toilet paper, hand soap, and hand towels, dryers in every bathroom, clean blankets, pillows, and sheets, shelter available for at least 8 hours of sleep, secure property storage, emergency disaster plans, laundry access, transportation at least 3 feet between beds and mats. We have no hearing scheduled yet, but appreciate your individual and organizational endorsement of this legislation. Please complete this form and email back with a new email if you'd like to review the entire legislation. You can go to sfgov.org. And if you want this, if you're interested in this this particular proposal, give me a call at 423-HUFF and I'll email it to you. Again, it reads, there are currently no minimum standards in San Francisco city-funded shelters, nor in Santa Cruz, as far as I know. Minimum standards are needed that would amend the San Francisco Administrative Code by adding a new Article 13 to Chapter 20 to require the city to include in all contracts for city-funded shelter services provisions relating to the standards of operations of the shelters and the contractual remedies for shelter operators' failure to comply with those standards, and two, take corrective enforcement measures, including seeking remedies for breach of contract against city-funded shelter operators that fail to comply with contractual provisions that the article requires. Finally, the ordinance establishes procedures by which a shelter operator can appeal the city's determination that liquidated damages are proper. We, the undersigned, endorse the minimum standards legislation, urge the San Francisco Board of Supervisors to make it into law. And again, this is Jennifer Friedenbach a Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco. And if you want to find out more from her, you can email her at director@cohsf.org. director@cohsf.org. She also sent me the bad news. The bad news is that Mayor Newsom is pushing for anti-homeless changes to the park code, which, of course, we've seen happening down here, too. Actually, not even changes to the code, just ex officio decrees by people like Ranger John Wallace or presumably Steve Hammack. We heard an interview with Pastor Dennis Adams, how he was told he would no longer, like any other group of people, be allowed to use the barbecue pits, allowed to do his Sunday meals in the park. They would just exclude him through an emergency law unless he found another place to go. So he's moved to the town clock on Sundays, an outrageous action by the city officials, particularly when it isn't justified by any kind of specifics that we heard of anyway. So this is what is happening with the park code. Newsom introduced some changes to park codes 312 and 313. Specifically, he was looking to broaden the definition of camping and extend the no sleeping hours from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. from essentially 8 hours to 12 hours, when you wouldn't be able to sleep. These changes drastically extend the police's ability and authority to hand out citations and promoted the idea that homeless people should be punished for being poor, or for being poor and having the effrontery to fall asleep at night. So yeah, the idea that you can sleep during the day, of course, is preposterous. And what it really means is that they're trying to eliminate people being there at all who are in any way need to sleep. So you're not going to be allowed to sleep, period. That's just how it is with our parks. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Who's calling?
Hey, this is Bob Patton. How you doing, Robert?
Hey, Bob, a human rights organization man. How are you?
Really good. I was going to talk to our lead attorney. I'll back up a minute. You were talking a little bit about the lawsuit before. You were reporting about the San Francisco email, and I'll refer to that. We were talking about the lawsuit we have here locally.
Uh-huh.
And David Beauvais from Berkeley is our lead attorney. Kate Wells here locally is his co-counsel.
Right.
And I had arranged with him to talk by phone about his hearing from the National Law Center on Homeless Poverty provided pro bono attorneys.
This is sort of like with more legal punch for the lawsuit against the sleeping ban, huh?
Yes, exactly. So it looks like, it looks like they have their posse now. However, a posse is going to have some long-range capability because it's from a firm in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
However, David seems to think, you know, at least that they were nice and dedicated.
How sweet.
So, yeah, how sweet that is. See how much mileage we get out of that posse. But anyways, that's a real positive plus. I wanted to get people a chance to let that go through their little noggins. And looks like the...
Well, let me understand this, Bob. The National Law Center for Homelessness and Poverty, which is a Washington, D.C.-based kind of research group that puts out annual reports on discrimination against the homeless in different areas, and also sometimes joins in lawsuits against anti-homeless laws. Are they volunteering attorneys to sign on to our lawsuit, or they're just patting us on the back, or what are they doing?
No, I'm stunned. I mean, Dave's actually accepted their offers, and he's got them working on legal research right now.
Putting them to work. Well, that sounds good to me.
Yeah, I know. I was stunned to hear that top-down, slow dragon National Law Center finally got something going for us. But it looks like we had to start up our own grassroots effort here to even get their attention. So David seems to be somewhat satisfied with them. You know, this nice and dedicated. That's better than flaky and demanding or something.
Well, I know that we have been kind of seeking out plaintiffs to do what Los Angeles did, which is challenge the
the law and the policies the police are using, which essentially say you can't sleep at night if you're homeless, which really means you can't sleep because people aren't, they don't usually sleep during the day, and that's the time people have to engage in business and go to get services and get work and do all the kinds of stuff you do during the day. So it really means get the fuck out of town if you can't sleep. And it's really an anti-homeless, you know, stance, which...
Yes, exactly.
You know, and I mean, you know, it's... the idea that it has any kind of credibility, which Mayor Coonerty, our new mayor, seems to feel it does. If you want to see Coonerty's position on this, you can go online. He has a debate he had with ACLU. We like to talk about it. We don't want to do shit about it in action. Attorney Don Zimmerman, and then our attorney, Kate Wells, who is working on this lawsuit to end the sleeping ban. It's available on the, as a community TV show, and you can go online to Humanity, I think it's humanityforhomeless.blogspot.com, which, you know, you can actually see Mayor Coonerty giving his rationale for why it should be illegal for people to sleep.
Yeah, please, if you like something that's an oxymoron kind of thing, then go there and listen to him talk about the issues. He doesn't seem to know squat about it.
Well, you'll need OxyContin after you listen to the...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm afraid Ryan is just not too well versed in it, which is kind of, it's interesting because he kind of postures as a person who knows what he's talking about. And I really, it's really kind of offensive and presumptuous that he does this.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and all his bands of people who are, you know, opposed to him and all his, he actually wrote Huff recently that we should abandon our protest at the bookshop Santa Cruz, which we do which we have been doing every week. Although I guess we're talking about what we're going to do next on this, in front of the bookshop, because it was increasing his business. I remember that one.
That's what I'm talking about, oxymoron. You know, it's like military intelligence or something like that. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, well, it's unfortunate when, you know, when merchants of a supposedly progressive store like the bookshop Santa Cruz, you know, aren't really willing to walk the walk, you know, or walk the talk when they become, you know, politicians and when they're trying to get into higher office. I think Coonerty acknowledged he was trying to get into higher office. That was his, you know, I think maybe it was Emily Riley is pushing for higher. I think Coonerty is also interested in higher office. And this is just, it's a political stepping stool game. And you know, the people that they're stepping on are poor people.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call that family very progressive whatsoever unless they want to talk about progressively take the money out of your pocket and put it in their pocket. Then.
You know, I think you're probably right, although I always do commend the Coonerty family for having, you know, an open public bathroom to even people who aren't customers. No other bookstore does that, or at least not consistently, not still. I guess Trader Joe's does it now, you know, and Safeway does it if you go up to Safeway on the west side. But most places... And small places, not non-corporate places, don't do it. Borders used to do it for a while and then stopped. And the city doesn't even do it. The city does not have bathrooms open 24 hours. I guess they have these primitive, they have a couple of bathrooms that are open now, but they aren't, you know, they are no way 24-hour bathrooms. They've been talking about having them for years, decades even, and haven't done diddly squat about them. But Coonerty, you know, the Coonerty family did have a 24-hour bathroom, but a bathroom that was open downtown. And they also allow John Maurer to sleep in the eaves of their store, and a couple other people too. Although, you know, that's the fact that three or four people can do that, and the rest of the community gets to be told you get arrested after 11 o'clock at night if the police want to bust you for sleeping, is not a very, you know. Not a very progressive position. So.
Yeah. Well, let me appeal to your listenership here. I know there's quite a few homeless people tune in, as they're turning in to listen to your program. So we still do need plaintiffs. If you've gotten a ticket lately, or whether it's been resolved or not, and you are currently homeless, please come to one of our meetings or approach one of our members or volunteers on the street. Usually you'll be able to identify them handing out literature either at, like in front of the Coonerty store there, right alongside Tom Scribner, the only, as far as I know, what they call free speech zone in the city. So look for us elsewhere
as you said, we're talking about maybe even going off Pacific or trying to attend some of the larger meals.
Yeah, the number to call, you know, if you want to get in touch with me is 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F. You can also come to the Human Rights Organization meeting, 2 o'clock at the Firefly Cafe on Saturday at
right.
2 o'clock at 131 Front Street. Or, you know, and there probably will be a protest in front of the bookshop at 2 o'clock on Sunday. Although it depends on the rain, I guess, and how that's going. It looks like the weather's getting pretty nasty out there.
Yeah, and I like to appeal to any of our supporters or those that have been, you know, dallying around thinking this is going to go nowhere. Yes, it's going somewhere. If you want to work with attorneys and legal smeagles and help with the plaintiffs, and we need some document pushers and people to search for stuff and search for the homeless people, too.
Yeah, if your property has been taken by Ranger Wallace, you know, if your campsite has been despoiled, if you're, you know, if you've been, you know, improperly dealt with by the police, these are all things that not just we need to know about, the community needs to know about this. This is stuff that is bad. And right now it looks like there might actually be some legal action going down here. I mean, we're hoping to get a lawsuit filed by early January on this issue, a federal lawsuit in San Jose to duplicate, as I said before, what Los Angeles has done. And what as a consequence, San Diego and Richmond have also done, which is...
Yeah, and that's, you know, very positive, very helpful. That's what we want to do here. We want to move to the high ground when it comes to human rights on, for everybody in this community. So it's not, we're not just against Ryan Coonerty. We're for human rights. We're for bringing people up in status in our community. We're for allowing people to appeal to their neighbors without having a threat of law, that their standard of living is not compatible to their health. They need to be able to appeal, you know, to the higher standards of this community. And these laws now are making those very vulnerable people that need the help, they're making them criminals instead. So that's the negative part. The positive part is we're doing something about it. So get on board. Let's go do something good. My spiel. Did you hang up on me?
No, I didn't hang up on you. I'm still here.
I thought maybe that was too positive for you.
No, yeah, you look too smiley for me, Patton. So thank you, Bob. And the Human Rights Organization does, again, meets on Saturday, 2 o'clock, if you want to check it out. If you want to be a plaintiff, or you know somebody who's been a plaintiff, or you are already a plaintiff, but you haven't been in touch with us because you couldn't make the last Saturday movie of Dark Days and where we met with the attorney, you know, we're not abandoning you, you know, but you got to get in touch with us or else, you know, we can't do anything. So,
right. We have some mobile interviewers, somewhat mobile, at least when they're not working. So
yeah, I mean, if you're at the town clock at, you know, on Sunday where there's a meal, tell Pastor Dennis Adams you want to be a plaintiff, and he'll get in touch with us and maybe talk to us about it.
You know? Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. I mean,
okay, Robert, well, thanks for letting me bring the issue there and update people.
No, thanks for talking about it, Bob.
I'll see you later.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Bathrobe's Piers Broadsides at 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. Let's get back to the streets and hear a little more from that protest against the sleeping ban in favor of human rights. Oh, Mayor Coonerty, you know, get wise.
Don't buy into bigotry at the bookshop Santa Cruz.
I was rocking out today.
Boycott bigotry downtown.
Okay.
Well, I don't know about that.
You go in there and
keep an eye on you there, Tim.
So the Navy
He said okay, but he's going into the bookshop Santa Cruz. Jim Fitzmaurice, one of our former mayors.
Maybe he's going to get that.
Was that Jim Fitzmaurice? Yes. Talking with
Denise Harrison of Felton.
And Denise, when's the last time you we had that encounter? Because my memory is getting very creaky.
It's been about a year or so, although I watch you faithfully on television
yes.
as often as possible.
And what do you think? Do you believe everything I say, for God's sake?
Oh, yes. I totally believe that everything you do is on behalf of the homeless and that you're a very great man.
She's coming home with me tonight.
So, thank goodness that you exist in the world because the homeless need a voice.
You're out of work yourself, looking for work.
Yes, I am. I got terminated from my job.
Because?
Because I reported a dog that was being treated cruelly in a parking lot of a local pet store.
And what job were you terminated from?
It was for a pet food company diet job that I worked for 2.5 years for.
Well, that's gratitude for you.
Yeah, it is.
That old corporate gratitude. It's kind of warms the cockles of your heart, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But I'll tell you, I was very upset about the pheromone spraying. I run an animal rescue out of pocket at my home, and when they were spraying the pheromones, it seemed like it was definitely an injustice against our civil rights. And it was hard enough for me to deal with it, knowing that I have outside animals, but to know that there were outside human beings that had no place to take shelter in general, or when they were blasting us with no permission on the pheromone spraying, I think that was totally wrong.
Somebody has to be experimented on. Why not the homeless? They are expendable, after all.
No, they're not expendable, and none of us are expendable, and it was, I believe, against our civil rights.
So you're still in Felton?
Still in Felton.
You actually own a home up there?
Oh, no, I rent.
You rent. Oh, dear. And how are you
subject to all the rent increases.
You ever been homeless yourself?
I've been very close to being homeless. Very close. And
how are you now?
Very sad. Just on marginal borderline on unemployment, minimal food stamps at $90 a month. It's not enough to feed a normal human being.
Wow. Well, here we're trying to end the sleeping ban by getting people to sign up for a lawsuit and also urging to a boycott bigotry at the bookshop Santa Cruz.
Okay.
Because we're concerned about Ryan Coonerty, the new mayor's policy.
Oh, no. Well, I think that whatever you believe in is a good thing because it really makes a difference in this town. And I hope we have more homeless shelters and more homeless people that are taken care of properly because of you.
Well, because of you too. Why not?
Oh, thank you.
All right.
You are persistent,
brother.
We're talking to
Tiny Chef
and another man who prefers to remain anomalous, so to speak. You live in a trailer.
Yes.
And you're also interested in street spirit. What interests you about this newspaper?
I like that it's written by the homeless people, so it gets their point of view.
Well, it's actually written by housed advocates, but Linda Lemaster is in a house, and she's writing a story about a homeless local in Santa Cruz, Craig, Canada, but it's about homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
What about this sleeping ban law that we're protesting in front of the bookshop? What's your sense about that?
Well, he's been harassed.
Somebody sneeze over there? Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, he's been harassed by it.
I have been harassed by it, and it's complete and utter bullshit. I mean,
when were you last, given that?
Cited for it. I'd say about a year ago or less. Lately, I've been having more luck getting away from cops.
And what happened on that occasion when you recited? Did you pay a fine? Did you go to warrant?
I got ticketed, then it went to warrant, then I went to jail for 4 days. It was a bunch of crap.
Because you didn't have anywhere to sleep.
Right, you know.
Now, is that the only thing you were jailed for, was the sleeping ticket?
In that case, yes.
And what month did you go to jail?
October.
Last year. They actually have changed their policy. They prefer to ruin your credit than waste their jail space on you. So I think as of January, February, they'll just add an additional $300 fine and send it out for civil collection.
Oh, that's just wonderful. I mean, the hospital's on my ass. And
doesn't make you feel better.
On my ass.
Come on, show some respect. Ryan Coonerty, the author of not this policy, but a supporter of the sleeping ban, will certainly appreciate your supporting him.
Oh, truly.
Yeah.
We've been talking with
Tanisha
and Rex.
Thank you very much, you guys.
No problem.
All right. And, well, yes. The bookshop Santa Cruz, as you know, is chief worker is Ryan Coonerty, who's the mayor. We're concerned about the fact that there's a sleeping ban, which he supports. We've got a lot of literature on that. And we'd like to see it lifted for the winter, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere. And because he is refusing to deal with that issue, we encourage you to talk to him about it before you buy it. No. Oh, he's a great guy. Why not? I don't talk to him much either.
Okay. And...
stay in the right.
All right. And you remember to boycott bigotry downtown.
I remember that.
Remember that.
Yeah, that's actually, you'll be upset.
Remember that. At the bookshop Santa Cruz, the mayor is the chief worker.
The right turn at the light again. That's usually it will have three dots instead of two. I don't want to.
It's public place. I don't really care.
No, I do.
Well, who do I get? What's your name?
I'll give you the number to the meter shop. You can call them and report.
And what this is a meter maid refusing to be tape recorded or protesting being tape recorded and saying she won't talk to the member of the public if they have a tape recorder on. And this is an interesting question, and we've talked about this issue when trying to make Public Records Act requests at the police station, at the parking department, and at the courts. That, you know, it's really the people at those windows don't have any choice but to be recorded in terms of the fact that they are in public, that they have no expectation of privacy, and that one member of the conversation wants to record it, and they have the right to do that. Particularly if they're being recorded for purposes of the public's seeing what they're doing, they can't really say no because they're getting paid by the public. You actually can't say no if you're on the street and people are recording you because you don't have that right. That you don't have no expectation of privacy in a public place. But it's particularly true for public officials, and it's outrageous that they will refuse to engage in services if you try to document what they're doing. You might say, well, you know, I wouldn't feel comfortable being tape recorded all the time. And the answer is, well, that's understandable. The question, though, is whether, you know, there's something you're doing that is inappropriate or whether, in fact, what you're doing is sufficiently in the public venue that it really is a matter of general interest to other people and or to the person who's trying to get services from you. You know, if you're not doing anything wrong, well, I guess that argument, if you're never doing anything wrong, if you're not doing anything wrong, you shouldn't be worried about being recorded. That's something the police will often use to say, well, if you're not afraid of it, why don't you answer the question or why don't you show me, you know, what's in the bag? You shouldn't be fooled by that one. And I'm wondering if the argument I just made is similar to what the police officer would say or has said. And I think there's a difference. Police are looking for evidence of a crime. And they're not engaging in trying to get public service out of someone, such as we just heard with respect to a meter maid, or such as people seeking public records are getting.
So that was an incident with a parking meter maid across the street in front of the New York Bagels. Actually, it's Noah's New York Bagels. Apparently, Bob Patton is having a chat with the meter maid who refused to be recorded in public, or said she wouldn't talk to Bob if Tim here recorded her in public. So that's interesting. We had the same incident happen on the radio earlier today. It's inappropriate behavior for public servants to say they're not.
Anything, all this stuff's free.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
For public servants to say that they won't, or to refuse to provide service.
You heard it twice here on Free Radio.
Just because they're being recorded. In fact, they should be proud to be recorded, or at least not afraid of it. At least that's my belief.
Let anybody know where you hide away. Nobody likes your looks. We don't read of you in books. We're letting you all know it by our dirty, dirty looks. Oh, jingle bells, homeless smells, showered for a week. Bathroom clogged overnight with a cop playing hide and seek. Soup and bread every day till calming out our ears. Socks and clothes in plastic bags and a worse fare change in years.
And it looks like a long space on the tape here. So it's back to the San Francisco Park Code, which apparently is coming up for a vote on Monday when the Board of Supervisors. Mayor Newsom is trying to extend the no sleeping hours in the Park Code. And also, let's see, the Coalition on Homelessness and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights up in San Francisco teamed up and proposed an amendment that states that an individual cannot be cited unless they've been offered services and if they rejected those services. the mayor responded, proposed a counter amendment saying that folks will be in violation if they've been cited before, whether or not they were offered services, and if they're unable to find services within 24 hours and receive proof of services. So the mayor just wants them homeless out of Golden Gate Park. That's just how it is. And if they don't find a place, well, that's just how it goes. Just get the fuck out of town. That's coming up in San Francisco. And I think I was reading to you last show, for those of you who follow this whole series of programs regularly, that Berkeley passed a similar law called the Public Commons for Everyone, which we call the Public Commons for Everyone for the Homeless initiatives, which essentially allows the police, it goes back on what was passed in 2000, which stops the Berkeley Police Department from using the state anti-lodging law, 647J, to go after homeless people unless they have at least one warning, and they've got to give two warnings and have a complaint. Now they only have to give one warning, and they don't have to have a complaint. So it allows them to harass people for sleeping, sitting, and that sort of thing. I think it's sitting, not sleeping, in Berkeley. Berkeley has a complicated set of laws, which I should be more up on, but I'm going to have to review them. So, I actually wanted to do a little more reading from this book, which I began to read from, gosh, it must have been a month or two ago, called How Nonviolence Protects the State by Peter Gelderloos. And it's, we had a little kind of discussion about this on the air about 2 weeks ago, I believe, or it wasn't really about this particular essay, but the question of whether there is a kind of a, well, one person called in and she said that she believed that force should never be used, at least in a premeditated way, to defend yourself, that it was always better to use nonviolence. And some movements, it's been kind of a dogma in a lot of movements that you're not allowed to even consider using any kind of force or violence, and regardless of what the police department or the state does. And this is an analysis called How Nonviolence Protects the State. I'm probably reading some of what I read before, but hey, it probably bears, I'll kind of jump ahead a little bit so that we don't try to do too much duplication. The pacifist theory of India's independence movement, Gandhi, nonviolence, and so forth, is a selective and incomplete picture. Nonviolence was not universal in India. Resistance to British colonialism included enough militancy that the Gandhian method can be viewed more accurately as one of several competing forms of popular resistance. As part of a disturbingly universal pattern, pacifists white out these other forms of resistance and help propagate the false history that Gandhi and his disciples were the lone masthead and rudder of Indian resistance. Ignored are important militant leaders like Chandra Sekhar Azad, who fought in armed struggle against the British colonizers, and revolutionaries such as Bhagat Singh, who won mass support for bombings and assassinations as part of a struggle to accomplish the overthrow of both foreign and Indian capitalism. The pacifist history of India's struggle cannot make any sense of the fact that Subhas Chandra Bose, the militant candidate, was twice elected president of the Indian National Congress in 1938 and 1939, while Gandhi was perhaps the most singularly influential and popular figure in India's independence struggle. The leadership position he assumed did not always enjoy the consistent backing of the masses. Gandhi lost so much support from Indians when he called off the movement after the 1922 riot that when the British locked him up afterward, quote, not a ripple of protest arose in India at his arrest. Significantly, history remembers Gandhi above all others not because he represented the unanimous voice of India, but because of all the attention he was given by the British press and the prominence he received from being included in important negotiations with the British colonial government. When we remember that history is written by the victors, another layer of the myth of Indian independence comes unraveled. The sorriest part of pacifists' claim that the independence of India is a victory for nonviolence
is that this claim plays directly into the historical fabrication carried out in the interests of white supremacist imperialist states that colonized the global South. Liberation movement in India failed. The British were not forced to quit India. Rather, they chose to transfer the territory from direct colonial rule to neo-colonial rule. What kind of victory allows the losing side to dictate the time and manner of the victor's ascendancy? The British authored the new constitution and turned power over to hand-picked successors. They fanned the flames of religious and ethnic separation so that India would be divided against itself, prevented from gaining peace and prosperity, and dependent on military aid and other support from Euro-American states. India is still exploited by Euro-American corporations, though several new Indian corporations, mostly subsidiaries, have joined in the pillaging and still provide resources and markets for the imperialist states. In many ways, the poverty of its people has deepened and the exploitation has become more efficient. Independence from colonial rule has given India more autonomy in a few areas, and it has certainly allowed a handful of Indians to sit in the seats of power, but the exploitation and commoditization of the commons and of culture have deepened. Moreover, India lost a clear opportunity for meaningful liberation from an easily recognizable foreign oppressor. Any liberation movement now would have to go up against the confounding dynamics of nationalism and ethnic religious rivalry in order to abolish a domestic capitalism and government that are far more developed. On balance, the independence movement proves to have failed. The claim of a pacifist victory in capping the nuclear arms race, he's talking about pacifists have made a number of claims that they pacifism won in India, pacifism won in stopping the nuclear arms race in the, let's say the nuclear freeze in the 80s. Once again, the movement was not exclusively nonviolent. It included groups that carried out a number of bombings and other acts of sabotage or guerrilla warfare. And again, the victory is a dubious one. The much-ignored non-proliferation treaties only came after the arms race had already been won, with the U.S. as undisputed nuclear hegemon in possession of more nuclear weapons than was even practical or useful. And it seems clear that proliferation continues as needed, currently in the form of tactical nuke development and a new wave of proposed nuclear power facilities. Really, the entire issue seems to have been settled more as a matter of internal policy within the government than as a conflict between a social movement and a government. Chernobyl and several near meltdowns in the U.S. showed that nuclear energy, a necessary component of nuclear arms development, was something of a liability, and it doesn't take a protester to question the usefulness, even to a government bent on conquering the world, of diverting staggering resources toward nuclear proliferation when you already have enough bombs to blow up the entire planet, and every single war and covert action since 1945 has been fought with other technologies. The U.S. civil rights movement is one of the most important episodes in the pacifist history. Across the world, people see it as an example of nonviolent victory. But like the other examples discussed here, it was neither a victory nor nonviolent. The movement was successful in ending de jure segregation, that means segregation specified by law, and expanding the minuscule black petty bourgeoisie. But these were not the only demands of the majority of movement participants. They wanted full political and economic equality, and many also wanted black liberation in the form of black nationalism, black intercommunalism, or some other independence from white imperialism. None of these demands were met, not equality and certainly not liberation. People of color still have lower average incomes, poorer access to housing and health care, and poorer health care than white people. De facto segregation still exists. Political equality is also lacking. Millions of voters, most of them black, are disenfranchised from voting for white candidates in a white political system that reflects a white culture when it is convenient to ruling interests. And only four black senators have served since Reconstruction. This book was written in 2003. Other races have been also missed by the mythical fruits of civil rights. Latino and Asian immigrants are especially vulnerable to abuse, deportation, denial of social services they pay taxes for, and toxic and backbreaking labor in sweatshops or as migrant agricultural laborers. Muslims and Arabs are taking the brunt of the post-September 11th repression, while a society that has anointed itself colorblind evinces nary a twinge of hypocrisy. Native peoples are kept so low on the socioeconomic ladder as to remain invisible except for the occasional symbolic manifestation of U.S. multiculturalism, the stereotype sporting mascot or hula girl doll that obscures the reality of actual indigenous people. The common projection, primarily by white progressives, pacifists, educators, historians, and government officials, is that the movement against racial oppression in the United States was primarily nonviolent. On the contrary, though pacifist groups such as Martin Luther King Jr.'s Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, had considerable power and influence, popular support within the movement, especially among poor black people, increasingly gravitated toward militant revolutionary groups such as the Black Panther Party. According to a 1970 Harris poll, 66% of African Americans said the activities of the Black Panther Party gave them pride, and 43% said the party represented their own views. In fact, militant struggle had long been a part of black people's resistance to white supremacy. Mumia Abu-Jamal boldly documents this history in his 2004 book, We Want Freedom. He writes, "The roots of armed resistance run deep in African American history. Only those who ignore this fact see the Black Panther Party as somehow foreign to our common historical inheritance. In reality, the nonviolent segments cannot be distilled and separated from the revolutionary parts of the movement, though alienation and bad blood encouraged by the state often existed between them. Pacifist, middle-class black activists, including King, got much of their power from the specter of black resistance and the presence of armed black revolutionaries." In the spring of 1963, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Birmingham campaign was looking like it would be a repeat of the dismally failed action in Albany, Georgia, where a 9-month civil disobedience campaign in 1961 demonstrated the powerlessness of nonviolent protesters against a government with seemingly bottomless jails, and where on July 24, 1962, rioting youth took over whole blocks for a night and forced the police to retreat from the ghetto, demonstrating that a year after the nonviolent campaign, black people in Albany still struggled against racism, but they had lost their preference for nonviolence. Then, on May 7th in Birmingham, after continued police violence, 3,000 black people began fighting back, pelting the police with rocks and bottles. Just 2 days later, Birmingham, up until then an inflexible bastion of segregation, agreed to desegregate downtown stores, and President Kennedy backed the agreement with federal guarantees. The next day, after local white supremacists bombed a black home and a black business, thousands of black people rioted again, seizing a 9-block area, destroying police cars, injuring several cops, including the chief inspector, and burning white businesses. A month and a day later, President Kennedy was calling for Congress to pass the Civil Rights Act, ending several years of a strategy to stall the civil rights movement. Perhaps the largest of the limited, if not hollow, victories of the civil rights movement came when black people demonstrated they would not remain peaceful forever. Faced with the two alternatives, the white power structure chose to negotiate with the pacifists, and we have seen the results. The claim that the U.S. peace movement ended the war against Vietnam contains the usual set of flaws. The criticism has been well made by Ward, Churchill, and others, so I'll only summarize it. With unforgivable self-righteousness, peace activists ignore that 3 to 5 million Indochinese died in the fight against the U.S. military. Tens of thousands of U.S. troops were killed and hundreds of thousands wounded. Other troops, demoralized by all the bloodshed, had become highly ineffective and rebellious, and the U.S. was losing political capital and going fiscally bankrupt to a point where pro-war politicians began calling for a strategic withdrawal, especially after the Tet Offensive proved the war to be unwinnable, in the words of many at the time. The U.S. government was not forced to pull out by peaceful protests. It was defeated politically and militarily. As evidence of this, Ward Churchill cites the victory of Republican Richard Nixon and the lack of an anti-war nominee within the Democratic Party in 1968, near the height of the anti-war movement. One could also add Nixon's re-election in 1972, after 4 years of escalation and genocide, to demonstrate the powerlessness of the peace movement in speaking truth to power. In fact, the principled peace movement dissolved in tandem with the withdrawal of U.S. troops, completed in 1973. The movement was less responsive to history's largest ever bombing campaign, targeting civilians, which intensified after troop withdrawal from Vietnam, or the continued occupation of South Vietnam by a U.S.-trained and financed military dictatorship. In other words, the movement retired and rewarded Nixon with re-election once Americans and not Vietnamese were out of harm's way. The U.S. peace movement failed to bring peace. U.S. imperialism continued unabated, and though its chosen military strategy was defeated by the Vietnamese, the U.S. still accomplished its overall policy objectives in due time, precisely because of the failure of the peace movement to make any domestic changes. Some pacifists will point out the huge number of conscientious objectors who refused to fight to salvage some semblance of a nonviolent victory. But it should be obvious that the proliferation of objectors and draft dodgers cannot redeem pacifist tactics. Especially in such a militaristic society, the likelihood of soldiers refusing to fight is proportional to their expectations of facing a violent opposition that might kill or maim them. Without the violent resistance of the Vietnamese, there would have been no need for a draft. Without a draft, the self-serving nonviolent resistance in North America would hardly have existed. Far more significant than passive conscientious objectors were the growing rebellions, especially by black, Latino, and indigenous troops within the military. The U.S. government's intentional plan in response to black urban riots of taking unemployed young black men off the streets and into the military backfired. Washington officials visiting army bases were freaked out at the development of black militant culture. Astonished brass would watch as local settler white officers would be forced to return salutes to new Afrikaans black officers, giving them the power sign of the raised fist. Nixon had to get the troops out of Vietnam fast or risk losing his army. Fragging, sabotage, refusal to fight, rioting in the stockades, and aiding the enemy, all activities of U.S. soldiers, contributed significantly to the U.S. government's decision to pull out ground troops. As Colonel Robert D. Heinel stated in June 1971, by every conceivable indicator, our army that remains in Vietnam is in a state approaching collapse, with individual units avoiding or having refused combat, murdering their officers and non-commissioned officers, drug-ridden and dispirited, where not near mutinous. Elsewhere than Vietnam, the situation is nearly as serious. The Pentagon estimated that 3% of officers and non-coms killed in Vietnam from 1961 to 1972 were killed in fraggings by their own troops. This estimate doesn't even take into account killings by stabbing or shooting. In many instances, soldiers in a unit pooled their money to raise a bounty for the killing of an unpopular officer. Matthew Rinaldi identifies working-class blacks and Latinos in the military who did not identify with the pacifism-at-any-price tactics of the civil rights movement that had come before them as major actors in the militant resistance that crippled the U.S. military during the Vietnam War. And though they were less politically significant than resistance in the military, in general, bombings and other acts of violence in protest of the war on white college campuses, including most of the elite universities, should not be ignored in favor of the pacifist whitewash. In the 1969-1970 school year, September through May, a conservative estimate counts 174 anti-war bombings on campuses, and at least 70 off-campus bombings and other violent attacks targeting ROTC buildings, government buildings, and corporate offices. Additionally, 230 campus protests included physical violence, and 410 included damage to property. In conclusion, what was a very limited victory, the withdrawal of ground troops after many years of warfare, can be most clearly attributed to two factors: the successful and sustained violent resistance of the Vietnamese, which caused U.S. policymakers to realize they could not win, and the militant and often lethal resistance of the U.S. ground troops themselves, which was caused by demoralization from the effective violence of their enemy and political militancy spreading from the contemporaneous black liberation movement. The domestic anti-war movement clearly worried U.S. policymakers, but it had certainly not become powerful enough that we can say it forced the government to do anything. And in any case, its most forceful elements used violent protests, bombings, and property destruction. Perhaps confused by their own false history of the peace movement during the Vietnam War, U.S. pacifist organizers in the 21st century seem to expect a repeat of the victory that never happened in their plans to stop the invasion of Iraq. On February 15, 2003, as the U.S. government moved toward war with Iraq, weekend protests worldwide by millions of anti-war activists delivered a stinging rebuke to Washington and its allies. The unprecedented wave of demonstrations further clouded U.S. war plans, according to an article on the website of the nonviolent anti-war group United for Peace and Justice. The article, which exults in the massive display of pacifist feeling, goes on to project that the White House appears to have been rattled by the surge in resistance to its calls for quick military action. The protests were the largest in history, excepting a few minor scuffles. They were entirely nonviolent, and organizers celebrated their massiveness and peacefulness. Some groups, like United for Peace and Justice, even suggested the protests might avert the war. Of course, they were totally wrong, and the protests totally ineffective. The invasion occurred as planned, despite the millions of people nominally, peacefully, and powerlessly opposed to it. The anti-war movement did nothing to change the power relationships in the United States. Bush received substantial political capital for invading Iraq and was not faced with a backlash until the war and occupation effort began to show signs of failure due to effective armed resistance of the Iraqi people. The so-called opposition did not even manifest within the official political landscape. The one anti-war candidate in the Democratic Party, Dennis Kucinich, was never for a moment taken seriously as a contender, and his supporters eventually fled their moral high ground to defer to the Democratic Party platform's support for the occupation of Iraq. A good case study regarding the efficacy of nonviolent protests can be seen in Spain's involvement with the U.S.-led occupation. Spain, with 1,300 troops, is one of the largest junior partners in the Coalition of the Willing. More than 1 million Spaniards protested the invasion, and 80% of the Spanish population was opposed to it. But their commitment to peace ended there. They did nothing to actually prevent Spanish military support for invasion and occupation. Because they remained passive and did nothing to disempower the leadership, they remained as powerless as the citizens of any democracy. Not only was Prime Minister Aznar able and allowed to go to war, he was expected by all forecasts to win re-election until the bombings. On March 11, 2004, just days before the voting booths opened, multiple bombs planted by an Al-Qaeda-linked cell exploded in Madrid train stations, killing 191 people and injuring thousands more. Directly because of this, Aznar and his party lost in the polls, and the Socialists, the major party with the anti-war program, were elected into power. The U.S.-led coalition shrunk with the loss of 1,300 Spanish troops and promptly shrunk again after the Dominican Republic and Honduras also pulled out their troops. Whereas millions of peaceful activists voting in the streets like good sheep have not weakened the brutal occupation in any measurable way, a few dozen terrorists willing to slaughter non-combatants were able to cause the withdrawal of more than 1,000 occupation troops. I'm coming to the end of my show. This is a reading from How Nonviolence Protects the State by Peter Gelderloos. You're tuned to Free Radio. Let's hear a little, take a break from the serious by having a bit of, here's a little something from the Capitol Steps, and soon we're going to have Uncle Dennis from the Cream to the Dregs.
All right, passengers, let's keep this line moving. Take everything out of your carry-on bag, put it on the belt, remove all clothing. You know the rules. Shampoos and shave creams and calamine lotions, toothpaste and tinctures and mouthwashing potions, ointments you smooth on your skin when you're dry. These are the things you can't take when you fly. Hey, you with the baby, next thing I'll pronounce is I'll bet that diaper holds more than 4 ounces. Give me her juice box and don't let her cry. If wet, we won't let you on board when we fly. Change that diaper, I could wipe her. This is not a game. She's wet, you can't take her. I'll tag her and then just get her a baggage claim.
All right, let's keep the line moving. No liquids, no gels. Oh, Rush Limbaugh, good to see you again. Well, you know the rules. Come on, let me check your bag. What's this? Performance-enhancing drugs?
I know what you're thinking.
Yeah, what everyone else is thinking. Who the hell's having sex with you?
The airlines found Russia's little blue pill supply.
Viagra, 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 Viagra.
gives new meaning to the phrase upright and locked position when I fly.
Viagra, 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 Viagra.
Viagra, my doc's got me hooked on Viagra.
Don't think I can be tricked.
I'll get my problem licked. All right.
Viagra, first dough, now it's a rush on Viagra. Why is it the right wing has problems with their thing?
Dear listeners, I'd like to make one small correction. I said we're in for one hard election.
I'm not sure that women will flock to Mount Rushmore.
My problem is plain to see. Haven't been able to perform since I first heard the words President Hillary. Well, I really do lean to the right.
With Viagra.
And Robert finishing up his show there with a little bit of comedy from the Capitol Steps off of a CD called Springtime for Liberals. Of course, Robert will be back in the studio on Sunday, provided he doesn't wash away down some local river. There's your CD, Robert.
Thank you.
Hey, it's good stuff, too. I'm Uncle Dennis. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're at 101.1, and we're also at www.freakradio.org. This next show coming up is From the Cream to the Dregs, an exploration of the music of the 60s and the 70s. And let's start out with some Derek and the Dominoes.
You can't leave her alone.